When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you like this podcast, can we recommend another one? It's called Big Picture Science. You can hear it wherever you get your podcasts, and its name tells part of the story. The big picture questions and the most interesting research in science.
Seth and I are the hosts. Seth is a scientist. I am Molly, and I'm a science journalist. And we talk to people smarter than us, and we have fun along the way. The show is called Big Picture Science, and as Seth said, you can hear it wherever you get your podcasts.
What follows may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The world is full of stories. Stories of mysteries. Of curiosities. Of oddities. Join Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
So I'm in Ecuador, you're in Maine, and here we are doing another episode, and it is weird sitting across the table from an empty chair.
Yeah, I can't say I care for this. I don't like it.
No.
And my company right now is a cat that does not respect me. And so it's weird.
How so? There's a cat at the place you're staying because you're actually watching somebody's cat and you're being bullied by a feline.
Mm-hmm. He's very demanding. And if I don't like give him what he wants exactly when he wants it, he'll bat me in the face.
Oh, my God. Lukey's doing pretty well here. At first, he was really sad that you weren't here. And now he wants to plan a rager for the weekend. And I told him I didn't think you'd think that was a very good idea, but he seems determined.
Well, I'm sure he's got a lot of street friends that he hasn't seen in a while. So,
also, I'm having a really bad hair day, so I'm wearing my headphones for those
of you
watching.
I was going to say, it's especially fluffy today.
Yeah, it's, I don't know what it is. Well, I know what it is. I need a haircut.
You need a haircut.
And I haven't gotten around to it yet, so I'm hiding the fluff as best as I can.
I had to pull mine back because my hair, without this barrette in, I was noticing I'm starting to look like Corey's friend from Boy Meets World. Like, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you're saying. I don't remember what the kid's name was, but yeah.
I think that I shouldn't have done that, but I did. So let's just move on. Do you have a story for me?
I do. Have you ever heard about a tiny creature that can bounce back to its younger self, dodging the Grim Reaper, kind of like a real world animal version of Benjamin Button?
I thought that movie was so fucking creepy.
I hated that movie.
Yeah.
But this is not fiction. This is real. The immortal jellyfish.
Yes.
It's a creature that sounds like it was made up, you know, cooked up in a sci-fi lab or something. But it's a real thing. Imagine if you could go back to being a kid whenever life hits you with a curveball. I know probably you wouldn't want to know. Okay.
No, thank you.
So the whole thing begins in the Mediterranean Sea. But thanks to humans zipping across the world in their boats, jellyfish have hitched a ride to waters worldwide. And it's not just a freeloader, it's a survivor. It toughs out long trips and thrives in new places like it's always been their home. It's crazy.
Scientists, so they're like Jellyfish House Hunters International.
But without an HGTV contract. Scientists are amazed by this little creature, and they've been poking around in its DNA to figure out how it pulls off this Fountain of Youth act. What they found is that no matter where the jellyfish is in the world, no matter where it pops up, its DNA are exact copies of each other. They're genetically exact. It's like one big immortal family.
Like Invasion of the Body Snatchers?
Very much like that. And it poses a real brain teaser. If all of your parts have been replaced, are you still the same person? So our little immortal friend starts off as a larvae. And, you know, he's kind of kicking around the ocean, free-spirited lifestyle, wandering the seas. Kind of like a jellyfish version of leaving the nest and going to college. Except, instead of dorms, they live on the ocean floor. As they grow up, these polyps branch out and they grow and become basically the type of jellyfish that we're used to seeing in aquariums and zoos and...
Those guys.
Yeah. But when something happens, maybe it's an injury or a sickness or whatever the case may be, these jellyfish can hit the do-over button and go back to being a polyp again and live their lives all over. This do-over scientifically is termed transdifferentiation, and it's pretty fascinating, if not outright mind-boggling. It means that an adult jellyfish cell can turn itself into a completely different type, essentially de-aging and then re-specializing. It's as though each cell in their body can say, you know what, I'm tired of being a heart cell. I'm going to now be a bladder cell or something else.
Wow.
What's even more intriguing is how these jellyfish could revolutionize how we understand our own biology. Let's break down a little bit of the research that people are doing on this jellyfish.
Like in a nice way? Are they being nice to the jellyfish, do you
well,
think?
Well, I'm sure they're polite to them, yes. And but they are decoding its DNA and stuff. It's like cracking open a source code of life itself. They're looking at which genes are active when the jellyfish pulls off this backward aging stunt. And it's, you know, it's kind of a genetic puzzle, like a jigsaw puzzle, and they're piecing it together, trying to get a blueprint of how their cells rejuvenate. And the potential here is unbelievable. If we can break this code, we could potentially coax our cells to repair themselves after an injury or after combat, accident, disease, whatever the case may be. Things right now that we think are irreversible, this could change our outlook entirely.
Could it be applied to dogs?
Sure, why not? Like, okay.
Well, then I'm on board.
You find a street dog who doesn't have a leg. In theory, if they can figure out how this works, they could, you know, help the dog grow a new leg.
Okay.
They're dissecting its DNA, studying its environment, and putting the pieces together in hope that one day we might be able to unlock the secrets to our own biological time machines. Or dogs, I'm sure, you know, dogs too, or any animal.
Yeah.
We're not quite at the point of reversing our aging process yet. The immortal jellyfish has opened up a whole new field of possibilities. It's become a symbol of hope. It shows us that there's still so much for us to learn in the world around us. And who knows, perhaps the key to our own longevity lies in the DNA of this tiny little sea creature.
Yeah.
When the immortal jellyfish hits that biological rewind button, it's not just performing a cool party trick. It's challenging our understanding of what is possible in the world today. The prospect is tantalizing and raises as many questions as it does answers. What if we could learn to regenerate lost limbs? Starfish can do it. Or renew our cells to fight aging and disease, like the jellyfish can. The implications are staggering, and it could lead to a paradigm shift in how we treat a multitude of health issues. Researchers are already looking into the mechanics of stem cells, which have the potential to become any type of cell in the body. That's mind-blowing. The jellyfish's transdifferentiation takes this concept to the whole next level, allowing specialized adult cells to revert to a more primitive state and then transform into something entirely different. If this process can be understood and replicated, it will revolutionize stem cell therapy and open up whole new frontiers in personalized science.
Yeah, and trans differentiation would open up a whole new level of Scrabble if you had the right letters.
Yes. Yeah. Boy, that would be, how much would that one be worth? The path to such medical breakthroughs is, of course, littered with challenges. The first hurdle is a technical one. Can we replicate the jellyfish's cellular alchemy in human cells? The human body is vastly more complex than a jellyfish, and our cells are less malleable. The process that allows a jellyfish to essentially rebuild itself cell by cell may not be directly transferable to humans due to its complexities and of our tissues and our organs. Now, the second challenge is an ethical one, of course. Should we pursue a path that could lead to significantly extended lifespans? The potential for overpopulation, the environmental impact, the stratification of society between those who have access to such treatments and those who do not, and the very definition of what it means to live a good life. All of this comes into question.
Yeah, I just don't think it's a good idea for us to live a much longer than we already do.
Some would say we live too long already.
Yeah.
Dogs, on the other hand, while the immortal jellyfish's unique ability to reverse its aging process and sidestep death may seem like the stuff of myths and legend, it is very much a reality that could hold a key to unlocking new human health interventions. It's important to approach these possibilities with both optimism and caution, respecting the complexity of our own biology and the ethical implications of such profound advancements. And as we continue to unravel the mysteries of the immortal jellyfish, we may find that the greatest gifts this little tiny jellyfish offers are not the secrets to eternal life, but rather insights into the incredible regenerative powers of nature and the potential they hold for the future of human health and longevity. Just the information, just finding out how it works, whether we can transfer it or not, would be an amazing accomplishment.
It's really so interesting. And the sea creates incredible things. Lobster, they say, only die because of external reasons. Like, lobster live for so, so long if they're allowed to. And I don't know what it is about, like, deep sea animals, but they've got something special going on.
Wasn't there I can't remember if it was a dolphin or a whale or some sort of a deep sea creature that was discovered in the polar region. In researching it, they estimated it to be something like 500 years old. Crazy.
And that's amazing.
There's so much we don't understand. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. You know, as your kids get older, there are some things about parenting that gets easier. I remember once hearing my sister tell my little niece, "If you put your pants on, I'll give you some Fresca."
And when kids can start to reason that they get something if they do something right, it's a lot easier to manage them.
Having that conversation about money with your kids, that's not the easiest thing in the world. Fact is, kids won't really know how to manage their money until they're actually in charge of it. And that's where Greenlight can help.
Greenlight is a debit card and money app made just for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on the kids' spending and savings, while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills.
Your kids will learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely thanks to the games that teach kids skills in a fun, accessible way.
When I was a kid, I had expected chores, and then I had bonus chores. And bonus chores were where I earned money. And so if you're thinking like, hey, my kids should be doing stuff around the house, yeah, no, you're not wrong. But maybe there's extra ways that they can learn how to be a successful financial money person.
What was one of the bonus chores that you had to do?
Rub my mom's feet.
And what did that pay?
I don't know, like a quarter or something.
Millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate their life together.
Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/oddities. That's greenlight.com/oddities to try Greenlight for free.
Greenlight.com/oddities.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
In the late 19th century, Tennessee experienced significant population growth due to various factors. The state's population grew steadily as a result of natural increase in migration, and the end of the Civil War in 1865 also contributed to population growth as the state began to recover from the conflict. Industrialization and the expansion of railroads in Tennessee attracted people to urban centers, leading to urbanization and economic growth. And by the end of the 19th century, Tennessee's population had more than doubled compared to the pre-Civil War era.
Holy crap.
I know. Like, that's fast. And Nashville emerged as a major industrial and transportation hub in the region. Brushy State Prison, officially known as Tennessee State Prison, was built in 1898 in Nashville as part of the response to that population growth and the growing inmate population, as well as the need for a more secure correctional facility. The prison was designed to be a maximum security facility to house so-called dangerous criminals. Brushy Mountain gained recognition in the Guinness Book of World Records for its unique feature, a natural bluff integrated into its prison wall, a distinction unmatched by any other penitentiary in the United States.
Wow.
The initial prison was a wooden structure, also it was constructed by inmate labor. In the 1920s, though, it was replaced by a fortress-like edifice made of stone quarried, again, on-site by prisoners. The prison's new layout was crafted in the form of a Greek cross, which was to reflect the idea that the institution's mission was to foster conversion to Christianity among its inmates. But it wasn't just a jail. For decades, it was also a coal mine. Following the Civil War, railroad construction boomed, and the coal mining industry rapidly expanded across Tennessee.
So it was a coal mine and a penitentiary at the same time?
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah. And many of the coal deposits were in remote regions, like the location of Bushy. And these companies set up on-site stores selling essentials at high prices. You know, the whole idea. I sold my soul to the company store.
Yep.
You know how it goes. Mm-hmm. You've seen it. A convict lease system provided companies with a cheaper, more compliant workforce. I mean, You know what this is, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
system spread across the South as state governments sought to cut costs. Leasing convicts was a great way to do it to private industries so that they, you know, their involuntary servitude was a form of their capital punishment. But essentially, it was slavery. So Tennessee initiated prisoner leasing in 1866, with the Tennessee coal mine in Anderson County adopting the system in 1891. And that sparked the Coal Creek War, during which citizen miners rebelled against this unfair labor competition by attacking and setting fire to the state prison, stockades, and mines.
Yeah, it seems like that system was only good for, like, one party, and everybody else hated it.
Pretty much. The prisoners and guards were forcibly loaded onto a train and sent out of town, only to be returned by mining companies with state troops intervening. It was a mess. Now, in the prison, diseases such as tuberculosis, typhoid fever, pneumonia, and syphilis ran rampant among inmates. Shockingly, about 3/4 of the black prisoners were afflicted by syphilis alone. And the prison's medical care was substandard, as you can imagine.
Syphilis, if left untreated, oh my God, it has some horrific outcomes. Remember, we were at the Mutter Museum, and they had a skull of a man who had perished, and his whole face was eaten away by syphilis.
Yeah, and I mean, your brain, too. It really messes with every part of you, and not in a great way.
No, and now I feel bad complaining about my hair.
It looks great, and you don't have syphilis.
That's
so
true.
Really, things are going pretty well for you.
I'm pretty happy about the not syphilis thing.
To make matters worse, inmates faced brutal beatings for failing to meet mining quotas, even though they were already battling severe health issues because they weren't being addressed at all. Exacerbating these issues was overcrowding. In 1931, BMCC, as I'm calling it now, held nearly 1,000 inmates, which was far more than it was ever meant to hold, like almost by a third.
Wow.
And it housed some of the most dangerous inmates in the state, including those on death row, according to the Department of Correction Commissioner George Little. He said it was considered to be the final destination for a lot of inmates. Many walked in, never to walk out again. So, escape attempts, as you can imagine, were few and far between, with a remarkably low success rate. The only person from Morgan County to be executed, though, was an inmate from Brushy Mountain who killed a guard while trying to escape. And the inmate was sentenced to death in the electric chair, and that was carried out in 1939. It's understandable, though, why they'd want to escape.
Yeah.
The prison inflicted corporal punishment on its inmates, utilizing a disciplinary space called the hole.
The hole.
Yeah. The hole consisted of a bare room with a mattress and two buckets. One of the buckets was from water, and you could probably figure out what the other bucket was for.
Yeah. Were the buckets different colors to keep them separated, or?
I don't think you'd have much of a hard time figuring out which was which.
I don't know. You know, you come back from a long, hard day of making little rocks out of big rocks, and you're really thirsty. And before you know it, but they could solve it with different colored pails.
Yeah, that would definitely solve the problem. Again, this is very similar to the royal water / orange juice conversation that we had in the last episode where you were like, could the Nazis mistake it for orange juice? And I just don't know why you have such a hard time differentiating between liquids.
I'm just really concerned about various people in society and their liquid intake.
Okay. I appreciate your concern about hydration.
Very concerned about it.
The whole was devoid of heating or cooling or lighting. And you don't have to worry about them coming back from making little rocks from big rocks because they didn't leave the hole. It was you've been put in here and you're staying for days at a time in isolation. Again, no heating, no cooling, no lights.
No multicolored pails.
No, you wouldn't be able to see the multicolored pails because it's dark.
That makes it even worse. So maybe they should go to more of a texture difference between the two pails.
One of the most infamous instances transpired on June 10th, 1977. This is when James Earl Ray, the convicted assassin of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., orchestrated an escape along with six other inmates.
I just saw a documentary on how he escaped. He worked in the bakery, right? And he hid in a cart with a false bottom, and the top of it looked like, you know, there was fresh bread, and he got out that way. And part of the reason why he assassinated Martin Luther King is because there was a rumor going around in the penitentiary that there was $100,000 on Martin Luther King's head, and he believed that.
That's why it's important to check your sources.
For sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, despite their efforts, Ray's bid for liberty was short-lived, and he was tracked down within 58 hours. And part of the reason that it was so easy to catch these guys was because of the rugged terrain in which this prison is built. It's, you know, the side of a mountain in Tennessee. You're not just going to scootle out and catch a bus. Now, Brushy Mountain Correctional Complex was shut down in 2009, primarily due to budgetary concerns and the overcrowding issues. The aging infrastructure of the facility and the high cost of maintenance were contributing factors. It garnered a reputation not only for its history of incarceration, but its persistent rumors and allegations of hauntings within its walls. Over the years, numerous reports have surfaced from both former inmates and staff detailing eerie encounters and unexplained phenomena. Many attribute the purported hauntings to the prison's tumultuous past, which includes, as we've mentioned, the violence, the suffering, the death, and a history dating back to the early 20th century of people just being mistreated. Visitors to the abandoned complex reported hearing disembodied voices, footsteps echoing through the empty corridors, shadowy figures lurking in the darkness, and some claim to have felt a heavy, oppressive atmosphere or sudden drop in temperature, while others actually claim to have seen apparitions of guards and inmates. Despite efforts to debunk these stories, the allure of Brushy Mountain's alleged paranormal activity continues to draw curious visitors and very active imaginations.
Why couldn't you have just left it at that? Why did you have to throw in very active imaginations?
Well, it's easy to visit now and determine what's going on there for yourself. In 2018, Brushy Mountain was reopened to the public for tours and private events and car shows and concerts.
Interesting.
Yeah. It also houses a distillery that produces moonshine, vodka, whiskey, and liqueurs. In addition, it also features the Warden's Table Restaurant, which serves Southern and American favorites in a relaxed and comfortable setting.
That's interesting. That is a very interesting concept.
I know that you love abandoned places.
I do.
And exploring especially abandoned, allegedly haunted places. Mm-hmm. And this is a place that I would love to go to because they've got a distillery and a nice restaurant. So
so we can all be happy.
Right?
Something for everyone. Yeah.
I think it sounds great.
Yeah.
And, you know, we love Tennessee, so.
Yes, we do. I think I may have gotten my James Earl Ray escape stories mixed up because he was not recaptured 56 hours after he escaped. He was out for a long time. It wasn't until after he assassinated MLK that they caught up with him. So he busted out a couple of different times.
I got my information from Knox News, tourbrushy.com, which has all the details about the Warden's Table Restaurant, mm-hmm. Chattanooga Times, and Archive Today.
Fascinating. Let's go.
Yes, please.
And now, that thing in the middle.
After the Titanic sank, it was learned that many lives could have been saved if more lifeboats had been on board. The Eastland passenger ship decided that would be the best course to take. On the morning of July 24th, 1915, the Eastland passenger ship doubled up on lifeboats. The extra weight capsized the ship, and 844 people died.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day, 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rawl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever wondered what really happened to Amelia Earhart or the lost colony of Roanoke? Do you ever find yourself scouring the internet for vicious Victorians and their murders by gaslight? Or perhaps you're just sick and tired of women being constantly misrepresented or plain lied about throughout history? If so, join me, Katie Charlwood, history harlot and reader of books, on Who Did What Now, the history podcast that's not your history class. Part of the Airwave Media Network. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Adios, au revoir, au revoir de zen, my friends. Bye-bye. I'll be seeing you.
And now, today's highlight in history. On this date, somewhere in the world, some woman or man said something and some shit went down. Man, we loves us some history. This is the Box of Oddities.
I'm going to tell you about an ancient Egyptian instrument that, even though you've probably never heard of it, you've seen it before, I'm sure. It's often depicted in like hieroglyphic displays or carvings of pharaohs or priests. It's something that they carried in their hand quite frequently, like some sort of a staff.
Okay.
But it was more like a rattle. It typically consisted of a handle and a U-shaped metal frame, and it was often crafted from bronze or brass, and the frame could be temple-shaped, or it could be any number of shapes, a horseshoe shape. The frame would be set in with little crossbars between the opening of the U-shape or whatever it is.
Okay.
And on those little crossbars would be bangles. Not, you know, Susanna Hoff, but that would be appropriate because she walks like an Egyptian.
That's true.
You know, like what you see on a tambourine kind of thing, just little...
So kind of like shaped like a maraca, but instead working like a tambourine.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Okay.
And they were used in ceremonies and were thought to carry great power. It wasn't just a source of music. It was imbued with religious significance. It was associated with the goddess Hathor, and later on, with Isis, as Hathor's attributes merged with those of Isis. The association spread to use of the sistrum beyond Egypt as the cult of Isis expanded throughout the Roman Empire. So it started in Egypt, but it spread all over the place.
Mm.
Traditionally, this instrument was featured in prominent rituals, resonating through the temples and corridors of a civilization that was full of mystery and certainly grandeur. But could the sistrum have been more than just a musical artifact? Could its unique tone and frequency, in fact, have functioned as a key to another dimension? To open a stargate? Stop laughing at me.
No, I was thinking of something else.
Imagine a time when the air in the grand temples of Egypt was thick with incense, and the walls were humming with prayer. In these spaces, the sistrum was not merely just an object of musical expression, but it was said a pivotal component of rites and ceremonies. Its sound was believed to pacify the gods and banish malevolent spirits, hinting at power beyond our understanding. And we do know that there are healing frequencies and healing sounds. But what if its purpose extended even further? Could it be the Sistrum has served as a key to another dimension, a tool to bridge the earthly realm with that of the divine or the afterlife? Now, you love the movie Stargate.
I do.
So give this a chance, okay?
Okay.
Just, okay. The idea is not without merit. When one considers ancient Egyptians' deep investment in the afterlife, their intricate knowledge of sacred geometry, and their sophisticated belief in the power of sound and vibration. This hypothesis suggests that the specific tonal patterns and vibrations produced by the Sistrum could interact with the resonance of the stone on the temples, many of which were constructed with extraordinary understanding of acoustics. We know
right,
that.
And then that would amplify.
Yes.
The sound. I see what you're saying.
We've heard similar things about Stonehenge.
Yeah.
You see people go with drums and from the inside of Stonehenge, it acoustically makes a very mystical atmosphere. By activating certain frequencies, it's postulated that the Sistrum's sound waves might have been able to affect the energy fields around false doors, rendering them as passageways or stargates to other planes or dimensions. Now, false doors are all over the place. In temples, it'll look like a door that goes somewhere, but it's just carved into the side of a wall. The notion dovetails with the symbolic importance of the false doors themselves, entrances that they thought were for the spirits of the dead to travel to the afterlife.
Like in Beetlejuice.
Like in Beetlejuice.
You get what I'm saying.
Another one of your favorites.
I know.
These doors are decorated with carvings of the image of the Sistrum. Such symbolism on these portals, which were themselves an interface between the world of the living and the dead, and that's what the Egyptians believed, could be interpreted as an indication of the instrument's higher function. In essence, the Sistrum could have been viewed as kind of an acoustic key, its reverberations designed to unlock metaphysical doorways. To priests and practitioners of the time, orchestrating the delicate sound waves might have been akin to manipulating the very threads of reality, a practice that, although obscured by time, continues to tantalize with possibility of ancient technology that has been lost to this world. And it is grounded in science. Katrina Walls.
Yeah. Hi. You've been using the word tantalizing a lot lately.
I love the word tantalizing. I've also been using the word hermaphrodite a lot, too, and I'm not sure why.
Tantalize to me, I think, is too close to the word taste. So I don't.
Oh, you don't like.
I don't this, care for yeah. it.
You don't like the word taste. You don't like moist. What are other words you don't like?
No, that's fine. Just the three. Because if we talk about more, then people will start using them more. It's the nature of.
It's the way the world
the
works.
The nature of people.
So the Sistrum continued to resonate through history long after the fall of the pharaohs. It's also found a place, or it did, in ancient Greek culture. However, in these contexts, it wasn't always played as an instrument. Instead, it took on a symbolic role during sacrifices and festivals Ooh. And funeral rites. And that hinted at a deeper significance beyond mere sound production. The instrument's enduring presence in religious practices continues today, like in the Coptic and Ethiopian churches, where it accompanies the dance at significant festivals, underscoring its continued sacredness. Its use even stretches into modern practices today, like neo-pagan worship. The theory that the Sistrum might be linked to numerous false doors found in Egypt in tombs and temples is interesting. It's not tantalizing. These false doors often intricately are carved with rich decorations, and of course the outline or the relief in the stone of the Sistrum. And that could be more than coincidental, but the concept of false doors transcends Egyptian culture and can be found in forms around the globe. One such fascinating example is called the Gate of the Gods, and it's not far from where we are in Ecuador, or where I am. You're in Maine right now. It's located in the high Peruvian Andes. It's an ancient site not far from Lake Titicaca. That's another word I like saying a lot too, Titicaca. This stone structure, discovered in 1996, is rumored to be a portal through which ancient heroes would pass to join their gods. That's the legend. A large stone door, it's 7 meters high and 7 meters wide, and featuring a small recessed door at the base of the site, and it's attracted both scientific interest and mystical speculation. Does not have a carving of a sistrum on it, but there are other similar carvings, though there have not been recent excavations due to its status as a protected archaeological site. The lore surrounding it does suggest that it could be a portal to another, a dimension in the afterlife or the dimension of the gods.
And isn't it interesting, the parallels, once again, are Egypt and South America, because we've talked about the connections between the pyramids and the ideas that maybe there were certain places where extraterrestrials came and set up shop.
The various forms of the religions between that side of the globe and the other tell the same story.
Yeah.
They tell the story that our creators came from the heavens. Now, in addition to Peru's Gate of the Gods, other locations around the world are speculated to host stargates or portal-like structures. Sedona, Arizona is another place. It is actually known as the Doorway of the Gods. Local Native American legends speak of tunnels and gateways leading to other worlds. Sedona's natural geology and energy vortexes adds to its mystique, with some people reporting experiences of energy shifts and spiritual charges in that region. And I've experienced that myself.
Now, I have a question. You say Sedona, Arizona. I'm not sure where you mean.
It's near Schnebley Station.
Schnebley Station.
Yeah, that's...
But I'm not familiar with Sedona.
Yeah, that's a story that we told a while ago, and it may have been on Shallow End, but Lindsay Schnebley, my co-host on the Shallow End podcast, his family settled that area. The Schnebleys settled that area, and originally it had a post office, and the post office was located in Schnebley Station. But then he thought, maybe we'll change the name, and so he changed it to Sedona, which was the name of one of his children or grandchildren. I'm not really sure.
I thought it was his wife.
Maybe it was his wife. These sites are enveloped in modern mythology and ancient lore. The historical significance of the exact function of each structure does remain a mystery, but it bridges the gap between reality and the metaphysical. Whether these sites were intended as symbolic representations, astrological alignments, or have connections to lost civilizations or perhaps extraterrestrial or interterrestrial activity, it's a matter of ongoing debate and discussion. Could it be that the rhythmic shaking of the sistrum with its clattering metal discs, could it resonate at frequencies that could unlock these spiritual gateways? The idea mirrors the modern metaphysical notion that certain sounds and or vibrations can alter perceptions of reality and even affect the fabric of time and space itself. While the concept of a musical instrument functioning as a cosmic key might sound like science fiction, it resonates with the ancient Egyptians' advanced understanding of acoustics and their belief in the power of sound. Temples like those at Hathor, where the roof is adorned with sistrum carvings, suggests that these instruments they played a critical role in religious and metaphysical practices. So as we continue to explore this and interpret the relics of ancient Egypt, the sistrum stands out not just as a cultural artifact, but as perhaps much more, perhaps a potential key to ancient metaphysical technologies. Mm. Now, whether it truly could act as a portal opener may remain within the realm of speculation. But the sistrum undeniably holds a significant place in the rich history of Egyptian heritage, and it echoes down through the ages as a symbol of profound spiritual and metaphysical significance. And I said that they were using them still today. Would you like to hear what one sounds like?
Yes, please.
Kind of sounded like a 1984 version of Madonna being run over by a truck full of empty cans. I hope that that didn't open any portals near you. I don't know. That's not an ancient cistern. It's a a reproduction
that
based
makes a difference.
On. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think we're good, but you know, who knows? Anyway, I got my information from World History Encyclopedia, Encyclopedia Britannica, Gaia, and Wikipedia.
Very cool.
Hello, everyone. Stakuyi here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.
First, I wanted to thank Alec for sending me the story about Brushy Mountain Correctional Facility.
Okay.
I meant to say that first before I started that story, and then I got distracted. I mean, how could I not? Looking at your face.
Oh, you know. I thought you were referencing the history of a legendary penitentiary facility.
Oh, no.
That would be distracting to me.
It's just cute, cute little face.
You're gross.
Now we're moving along. In 1948, a series of peculiar events unfolded as individuals in Florida came across sizable three-toed tracks at Clearwater Beach. These prints measured approximately 14 inches in length and 11 inches wide. That's about 35 centimeters by 28 centimeters. And they seemed to originate from the ocean.
They're like three... Like a dinosaur kind of thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the stride was about 4 to 6 feet, or 1 to 2 meters-ish.
Okay.
So it was sizable.
It's a big animal.
They were found along the beach for miles before the creature that made them returned to the sea. Subsequently, these mysterious imprints surfaced on other beaches and along rivers' shores, even further inland, like 40 miles inland. Huh. The tracks wound up around the Pinellas Peninsula. Is that how you say that?
Pinellas County,
thank you. Heading north, skirting the St. Petersburg waterfront, and eventually finding a place next to the Courtney Campbell Causeway.
Which is where I worked, right next to the Courtney Campbell Causeway.
Oh, okay. We went across that once and you pointed it out, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I said, yeah, that's the building
I worked
in. That's
on the way to St. Petersburg. Is that right?
That's the Howard Franklin Bridge. Courtney Campbell Bridge connects Tampa with Clearwater Beach.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm.
And with traffic, that was JG.
Sports and weather on the fours.
All right. So also at the same time, sightings of unusual creatures were being recounted.
What year did you say this was?
1948.
48. Okay. That was, believe it or not, before my time.
Students alleged spotted a beast resembling a furry log with a boar's head swimming in the water.
A furry log with a boar's head.
Yes.
All right.
And descriptions of a towering bird standing 15 feet tall with alligator-like feet were being circulated.
Hmm.
At the same time, witnesses on a boat off the Florida Gulf Coast detailed encountering a massive penguin-like bird floating on the water before vanishing back into the sea.
Wow.
Yeah, of course. A giant penguin. You can imagine these occurrences garnered wild attention from newspapers. Are these tracks of some weird gigantic animal time forgot? The Times asked.
Probably.
Yeah. The police launched an investigation into the tracks, although their motives were somewhat murky, because why? Why would the police be involved in a penguin search? Their conclusion was unequivocally, if the tracks were indeed a prank, it was a really good one.
All right.
So researchers questioned regarding the creature dismissed its existence outright, except a few were very interested and suggested it could belong to a giant salamander.
I like the penguin idea.
Adding to the intrigue, British biologist Ivan Terence Sanderson, who later delved into pseudoscience and coined the term cryptozoology, conducted his own inquiries. And inquiries on behalf of the New York Herald Tribune and NBC, as the mysterious tracks persisted for over a decade.
What?
It's not a hoax, he said, that any man or body of men could know so much about wild animal life as to make the tracks in just a manner that they appear, but that they would also be able to carry out this time frame without anybody seeing them or giving them away is frankly, he said, incredible.
Well, the idea that the stride of the animal, you said, was 4 to 6 feet, and it went on for, in some cases, mile or so.
Yeah.
And this happened consistently for a decade. That's got to be one exhausted hoaxer.
The impressions, he went on, in the sand were too deep to have been made by man or machine. And he proposed that the footprints were made by none other than, yes, a colossal penguin standing at the height of 4.5 meters or 15 feet.
A 15-foot penguin.
Yeah.
I like this guy.
So over the next 10 years, the footprints of the Clearwater Monster appeared frequently on Clearwater Beach, on Indian Rocks Beach, on the Courtney Campbell Parkway, St. Petersburg Beach, on the beach at Sarasota. Wow. It captured the imagination of locals and sparked speculation about the existence of giant penguins roaming the beaches of Florida. And when newspapers picked up the story, it became a sensation, drawing crowds of curious onlookers hoping to spot the giant penguin.
Well, they're not stupid.
Right.
Who wouldn't want to see a 15-foot penguin? You got the family, you're on the beach, you're on Clearwater Beach, got your little cooler and your umbrella set up, and you're just about to take a bite into a sandwich when a giant penguin comes over and steals your lunch. Mm-hmm. That's what we all hope for. I think an encounter like that.
Yeah.
Oh, you think I'm kidding?
No. Do you know that would be like
yes.
peak yeah. Katrina Wall's moment?
Yeah,
like, a giant penguin stole my sandwich. It's like that time that I accidentally left a piece of bread on our cruise ship balcony. And,
accidentally.
And those big seagulls came over.
Yeah, and you accidentally left your camera on in slow-mo. It was a happy accident, I guess.
Happy accident. So
we got some real National Geographic shit footage.
Little by little, after about a decade, the sightings did start to slow. Now we're gonna zoom ahead to 1988, and a Times reporter was doing an interview with some local missionaries, and one of them said, "You know, you should really talk with Tony Signorini. We've been friends for a while, and he might have a secret that he wants to tell you." So this Times reporter went to Tony's house, and actually it was an auto repair shop, and Tony retrieved a box from under his workbench and pulled out giant iron shoes with three toes.
Okay. Did he manufacture those himself?
Yeah.
In his garage?
Yeah. So the entire scheme was orchestrated by Tony and his ex-boss, Stephen Al Williams. a well-known prankster in the area, I guess. I guess in the late 40s, everyone knew that Al was a big prankster.
Okay.
And Tony revealed that in 1948, Williams had come across a photograph in a National Geographic, and it was of a fossilized dinosaur footprint. And he looked at it and he thought, you know what we should do?
Without any hesitation.
Right. So they did some investigating, and they said that initially they had crafted them with plaster, but Al was like, this won't do because they weren't heavy enough. And so they weren't leaving the imprints the way that they wanted them to look. So they switched to pouring lead into molds at a local blacksmith shop. I mean, they were invested.
How much did these things weigh?
About 30 pounds each.
30 pounds each. How did they manage a 4 to 6 foot stride?
So they bolted the iron footprints to a pair of high top sneakers. And then one of them would don the high top sneakers, lace them up nice and tight.
Mm.
And then it would go like this. They would row out a small boat just offshore, one of them donning the 30 pound shoes.
This sounds like a recipe for disaster.
I know.
Don't fall overboard.
That's it.
Yeah.
For you.
Think you're a mob hit.
One of them would pop out of the boat, walk up onto the beach, and then take these huge strides by swinging one leg backward and using the weight of the 30-pound footprint to woof forward and allow that weight to propel him, so that was one step. And then he'd pull up the other leg and do the same thing. Swing it back, allow the weight to propel him forward.
So the authorities didn't stop to think that this giant 15-foot penguin was wearing one Converse sneaker?
No. He had them on both feet.
Oh, okay. All right. Gotcha.
Yeah. I'm so sorry if I didn't make that clear. 2 3-toed feet attached to 2 high-top sneakers.
So 60 pounds of iron, and they're in a rowboat.
Yeah.
To start with. Okay. Boy, they take pranking seriously there in Clearwater.
They did not fuck around. So then the boat would meet the other one down shore. He'd walk off the beach, or stride off the beach, however, and he'd get picked up in the boat, and they'd be on their way.
And this went on for a decade.
For a decade. It's thought that the prankster's intention was to, one, be absolutely awesome, and two, generate publicity for a local hotel. Oh, I'm sorry, motel.
Okay,
the Clearwater Beach Motel, which they managed, and they hoped that the mysterious footprints would capture the attention of the public and bring visitors to Florida, which it did.
Yeah. Those were the days when those types of establishments were referred to more as motor lodges.
Because you'd motor up to them.
And there was a lodge.
You'd lodge at the... Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
So, the Florida giant penguin is awesome. It's incredible for many reasons. First, the sheer absurdity of this concept. Like, yep, there's a giant penguin roaming the beaches of Florida. How did they not get spotted for 10 years?
Yeah.
Rowing up to beaches with giant iron feet.
Oh, I thought you meant the penguins.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. No, that's quite a feat, if you'll pardon the expression, in and of itself, to be able to pull this off for a decade and nobody sees it.
Yeah. I also wanted to mention earlier you said that you're sitting on the beach enjoying a sandwich, and I had a little chuckle, but I didn't want to interrupt you again, so I let sandwich fly.
All right.
Because on the beach, a sandwich.
What's the
favorite kind of lunch on it?
A sandwich.
Secondly, the fact that the pranksters managed to create such a convincing illusion with these feet and generate attention and like fool scientists who were like, nope, dudes couldn't do this. They don't know enough about penguins and their giant strides.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible.
I love it.
And I don't think that they really did that much research about penguins specifically. It's just...
It was inspired by a dinosaur footprint fossil.
That's right. But they just went with it. They flew with it, unlike a penguin might.
Now, well, at least in the air. They can fly underwater. Although 15-foot penguin, I don't know.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows what kind of amazing skills they'd have. Overall, this is creative. I love it. It's audacious. The audacity of these dudes, not to just think of an idea and go, you know, it'd be fun. But they went to a blacksmith shop.
I wonder if they had to swear the blacksmith to secrecy. They must have. He would have been wondering, what are you guys going to do with 230-foot penguin feet made of iron?
Maybe he just minded his own business. I don't care. You know, Clint just minds his own business. He's just out there, outside of town, cracking open geodes. Who knows?
Or they could have been bookends. It's hard to say.
Maybe. Anyway, it's a wonderful thing that happened in Florida once. It's probably my favorite Florida man story.
Not my favorite Florida man story. Boy, I couldn't pick one.
How could you? It involves a giant penguin. So obviously it's my favorite. I got my information from TampaDay.com, newspapers.com, and IFL Science. Big thanks, by the way, to Cass for sending me this story.
And thank you for hanging out with us here at the Box of Oddities. It's a very weird time for us, and we appreciate your patience. I'm in Ecuador with Lukey, and Kat is in Maine with her mom during her surgery. And we're not really sure how long this is going to be, but...
No, I had to buy a one-way ticket, and I hated it.
I hate all of this.
We've never been in different countries before.
Not separately.
That's what I mean.
No. It's weird. We were talking the other day that in the many, 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 many years that we have been together, we've never been apart for more than maybe a week at a time. And this could be 3 weeks, 4 weeks. We don't know.
We don't know.
So, anyway, thanks for your patience. Thanks for your support. If you could tell a friend about the Box of Oddities, and if you haven't, you know, clicked that subscribe button, please help us out there. Apple Podcasts really kind of screwed things up for podcasters when they released their new operating system, where it deleted all of the automatic downloads that you may have had on there. So, I mean, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then you're probably okay. But if you have friends that did, go back in and make sure that it's automatic download subscribe thing.
Some podcasts lost like 50% of their downloads. It's wild what happened.
Yeah, we've been more fortunate than that, but still we've seen a downtick of about 15-20% of Apple Podcast listeners. Everything else is up, but that one app. And one advertising company, one of the networks that sells advertising for podcasts, said because of that, between December and March, they lost $7 million or something like that.
It's crazy.
We've lost some, but we never made anywhere near close to that anyway, so... So that's good.
Yep. We didn't have it to lose.
Anyway, thanks for hanging out with us. We'll see you next time.
Until then, keep flying that freak flag.
And fly it proudly, you beautiful freak.
And so, let it be known that the Box of Oddities belongs to you, and its fate is in your hands. Therefore, it's been requested by those to whom I report to beseech you for assistance. We ask but one thing of you, to provide a 5-star rating and a positive review. True, that is two things. However, 'tis merely a 5-star rating and a positive review. Also, subscribe to us. Okay, so three things is all we ask. Three things and three things only. Henceforth, the Box of Oddities commits to the telling of stories. Stories of the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected. We wish to offer our deeply felt gratitude and appreciation for your patronage. TheBoxOfOddities.com. Copyright 2024. All rights reserved.